goal of the talk today really is what I'm going to highlight is that it's more than just the statistics of the number of papers, books, etc. It's really the clarity of thought and the influence that Maurice and Katie have had that's infused the entomological community. And I'm just going to present one example with the research of we've done on Ragulides through the years of how Katie and Maurice have really influenced our thinking and advanced our understanding of St. Patrick's speciation. And so today I'm going to present a synthesis of some of the tower's research interests in the form of a case study on Ragulides, showing how the evolution of insect seasonal cycles can initiate the speciation process. And sort of the theme or the goal, the end point that I want to reach, is showing how we're merging or beginning to merge the genetic and ecophysiological study of diapause with new technology, the omics. So we're really nearing a metamorphosis that's fulfilling Maurice and Catherine's vision for the importance of seasonal cycles as the beginning for new insect biodiversity. So here's our metamorphosis and the transformation of green lacewings into Ragulides pulmonella. And so what I want to do, this is just sort of an outline of the talk, is I want to introduce Ragulides pulmonella as a model for St. Patrick's speciation via host plant shifting from hawthorn to apple. I want to show how the host plant is really a seasonal resource island. Start to think that way. I then want to show how seasonal differences in host phenology differentially select on various aspects of diapause. I want to show how diapause life history adaptations translate into ecological reproductive isolation to initiate the speciation process. I want to touch upon some of the aspects of the genetics of diapause, and then show how we can merge these diapause ecophysiology with omics into a metamorphosis for a new beginning, new research avenues, and in fact understand metamorphosis itself as a process in doing so. So important messages that I want to sort of implant in your mind. It turns out to be very complicated. I'll try to step through it, but I really want to think about diapause as sort of of interacting modules. That it's not a single phenotype. There's multiple aspects to life history adaptation, life cycle adaptation. That host seasonality can exert differential selection pressures across these different modules during a host shift. And that the genetics of diapause also has some modular aspects to it. Some of these modules or some of the genes may have effects across different aspects of a life history cycle, and some of which may more specifically affect just different components of the diapause process itself. And it's the assembly of these different components together during a host shift that really can allow adaptation to these novel sort of host resource temporal islands. So with that, a little background about Ragulides pulmonella. It's a model for St. Patrick's speciation. The recent shift of the fly Ragulides pulmonella from hawthorns to apples has been cited as an example of incipient or host-race formation in action, if you would. And the basic premise here is that the ecological adaptation accompanying the shift to a new host plant really can generate ecological reproductive isolation that can start the ball rolling, that can initiate speciation in the absence of geographic isolation and in the face of gene flow. In Ragulides pulmonella, these apple and hawthorn host races that I touched on are really part of a sibling species complex. And so what I'm going to talk about today with respect to the apple and hawthorn host races could be applied writ large, and this is what Guy's has postulated, writ large, if you take it and extend it outward, to help explain the genesis of this whole sibling species complex, that all of these populations that are specialized on different host plants at least began the speciation process through similar host shifting and differential adaptation to the host plant environment. So when we think about a host plant ship, it really represents a novel resource island. The new plant, the new host, is novel in space, it can be, in chemistry and in nutrition, and also in time. That ripe host fruit represent different seasonal resource islands for mating, oviposition, and feeding. And that insects must match their life histories to the fruit availability in this case to maximize their fitness. And that these differences in life history timing therefore, or can be, particularly important ecological barriers separating many host plant specific taxa, especially for temperate insects. And in the case of Ragulates pomonella and the host races, apples and hawthorn trees fruit at different times of the season. There's about a 3 to 4 week difference in the peak availability of fruits on these plants. This is one of the real emphases of Maurice and Katie in thinking that host phenology is really a major life history challenge to insects, especially univoltine temperate insects with a limited lifespan, as is the case with Ragulates pomonella. And that most temperate insects possess a physiological diapause mechanism allowing them to optimize their life cycles to seasonal events. This is one of just major influences in my thinking in particular. And that by changing the timing and duration of the diapause, pitophagous insects can synchronize their life history cycles with new plants, with reproductive isolation arising as a byproduct of these seasonal shifts. So diapause, though, when we think about it, isn't really a single trait. I'll try to illustrate this now to you in sort of the different aspects that are involved in a host ship to apples. Remember, apples are our earlier fruiting tree, and we're going to look at what various aspects of the diapause profile have to change during a shift. And it's not just a single trait. Timing of adult eclosion is one of the key components, obviously, of this host shift. Apples and haws fruit at different times, and one consequence of this, if you think about it, is the races have to hit different seasonal targets. One difference between the races is that apple flies, we would suspect, will break diapause sooner and enclose earlier than hawthorn flies to match this difference in the seasonal availability of the resource islands. And in fact, we see this. These are controlled rearing experiments where we rear flies through for multiple generations in the lab on the same host fruit environment to remove environmental and maternal effects. And what we see is, in fact, it appears to be true. At St. Patrick's sites, apple race flies close about a little more than 2 weeks earlier than hawthorn race flies. But let's get back to this modular nature of diapause again. It's not a single trait. And if we shift our attention from that target of adult eclosion, right, and we think sort of earlier in the life cycle of these insects, we can also see, or start to see, hopefully, that the 3 to 4 week difference in the fruiting times of these host plants can also have consequences with respect to the pupal pre-wintering period. And that's because applefly larvae freeing in apple fruits will leave fruits, burrow into the ground, and pupate 3 to 4 weeks earlier than hawthorn fly pupae will. Right? So as a consequence of this, applefly pupae at St. Patrick's sites face longer and warmer pre-wintering periods in the soil than hawthorn fly pupae. Well, Ragulates is a facultative diapauser. That means if it's exposed to high temperature and long for a long period of time as pupae, a significant number of these flies will break diapause and initiate direct development and eclose as adults. And that can have disastrous fitness consequences out in nature. And as a consequence, we might predict that the earlier phenology of apples could also select for a deeper initial diapause depth in the apple race in order for these flies to avoid the detrimental consequences of non-diapause development. And in fact, we see this as well. When we do control rearing experiments again, we find that, in fact, at St. Patrick's sites, apple fly are more recalcitrant to non-diapause development than Hawthorn fly PPR, from 20% up to 80% decrease. So this matches as well. So what's the outcome of diapause adaptation? How does it translate to ecologically based reproductive isolation? Well, if we think about the closure time differences, we see that apple flies close earlier than Hawthorn flies out in the field, and so they're sexually active at an earlier period of time, and there's not complete overlap in the mating period of the apple and Hawthorn races. And this results in some allochronic isolation, that the populations breed at slightly different times. Also, we can see, if we think about initial diapause depth, that if, in fact, apple flies migrated over the Hawthorn trees, and there was overposition, we could get some prezygotic isolation because the offspring of these migrants would have diapause profiles that aren't really matched to the environmental conditions on the alternative host. Reduced fitness. We can also think that it could act as a postzygotic isolation barrier as well. And by that I mean, if in fact an apple fly migrant had moved over and mated with a Hawthorn fly, the hybrid offspring would have developmental profiles that wouldn't match the environmental conditions on either of the parental hosts as well. So the hybrids would have its sort of intermediate phenology or life history cycle, which could be detrimental as well. So diapause differences can act in various ways, in different ways, both prezygotically and postzygotically, to form ecological barriers to gene flow. So what about the genetics of the diapause adaptation? I'm going to show you some of our work from a population genetic approach to try to get at this question. And what we've learned over the years is we've found six putatively neutral allozyme markers on three different chromosomes that show frequency differences between the host races at St. Patrick's sites. So we can think about these first as sort of just genetic placemats. There's not fixed differences. What we have is a series of loci showing frequency differences between the races. It turns out that all of these loci are related to diapause. And this is just to show you some results for three of the loci on three different chromosomes, showing that there's a correlation between allele frequencies at these allozyme loci and the eclosion time of flies. Great. But then some perplexing things. If you look at the alleles, you'll see that alleles for later eclosion within all of the races. So if we're looking over here, here's the alleles in later eclosing individuals within a race, right? It turns out that these alleles are all at higher frequencies in the apple race than the Hawthorn race. The reverse of what we would expect, right? Because earlier I said apple flies, there's a genetically based differences for them to close before Hawthorn flies. But here I'm saying some of the alleles at some of the genes showing differences between the host races show that alleles for later eclosion that we'd expect to be involved in delayed development or more recalcitrance to diapause breakage, et cetera, actually seem to be present in higher frequency in the apple race than the Hawthorn race. So what did this tell us, or could tell us? Well, it may tell us then, or point to this modularity of diapause and selection on diapause, that in some way we're missing some of the genetic elements that are involved in the earlier eclosion of apple flies that override the allozyme effects. But in contrast, it turns out that the allozymes do a really good job as markers telling us about, at least with the relationships of that pre-wintering period. They're consistent with what's going on in the pre-wintering period, however. That is, it seems to be that these allozymes, alleles for later eclosion, delayed development, et cetera, and we said are in higher frequency, it turns out, in apple rays, right? So we might suspect maybe if we translate our thinking earlier on to that initial diapause step period, maybe what we could see is that's really where one part of the fundamental role they play. So how could we get at this question? Well, we could do selection experiments. And the rationale would be, if we lengthen the pre-wintering period, right, and these alleles are really associated with delayed development rates and recalcitrance to non-diatrous development, as we lengthen the pre-wintering period at warmer temperatures, we might expect to select more and more heavily to favor these apple race alleles for delayed development. And that's, in fact, what we see. Within both of the races, as we lengthen the pre-wintering period for pupae at a warm temperature, we see increased selection in the survivors, the overwintering survivorship, shifting towards apple race alleles. And we can do this in both of the races. And when we then look at something else, if we look at non-diapause developers, after 32 days, we start to get some individuals closing. We see a real high frequency of the Hawthorn race alleles in those non-diapausing individuals. So the allozymes do a really good job of predicting what's going on in that pre-wintering period. They're associated with occlusion time later on in the life cycle, but they're associated in a sort of paradoxical way with respect to that second module of diapause. Really strange, isn't it? So I've showed you what might be selecting, at least in the apple race. That is, longer, hotter pre-wintering periods seem to select for apple race alleles, right? But what's selecting for the Hawthorn race alleles? So far what we've done is essentially lengthen the pre-wintering period, make conditions warmer and hotter. Well, what do Hawthorn fly pupae face? They face shorter pre-wintering periods and colder temperatures. So what happens if, in fact, we subject pupae to those conditions? And we see something quite different. Essentially a gene-environment interaction, where the longer we increase the winter length, essentially more we stress the flies, if we initially give them colder conditions, we see allele frequency shifting in the opposite direction. The survivors become more Hawthorn-like. So, in fact, the genes don't necessarily act in a standard way. The environmental conditions is interacting with their effects on diapause to exert the selection pressures. So Hawthorn race alleles may be, at least for the allozymes, associated with faster development, maybe even more stored energy levels. I'll get to this in a second. In order for the fly to rapidly enter into a proper diapause stage before winter. And we can favor that by treating the pupae to cold conditions before winter. But if, in fact, under warm temperature conditions, the opposite is true, and those alleles are disfavored because the consequences is of rapid development, you'll have a non-diapausing fly. So there's a gene-environment interaction. Do these laboring experiments have any relationship with nature? And the answer is yes, they actually do. This is results from 11 years worth of studies at one of our St. Patrick sites in Grant, Michigan. And what we see in both of the races, but more dramatically in the Hawthorn race, when cold weather conditions are such in year one, we see a shift in the allele frequencies, right? From them being under cold conditions, real Hawthorn-like, in years where it's real warm, we see an effect in the following generation for them to become more, quote, apple-like. Within a race. So the races are tracking local environmental conditions, and there's fluctuations in the allele frequencies to track these local environmental conditions. So let me take a step back, because I've just thrown a lot at you. But what I'm essentially saying is you can think about diapause as sort of Lego blocks. And some of the components, right, some of the components may affect just a specific stage, both genetically and physiologically. And other components like the Alzheimer's, might extend through different stages. And what you're what's basically going on during a shift is that there's all this pre-standing genetic variation, and it's getting reassembled in different ways. So when there's a shift to the earlier fruiting apple phenology, the allozymes are moving over, and that's helping with respect to the pre-diapause recalcitrance to non-diapause development. But then there's selection for a different component that we don't yet have a handle on that has to be added, right, in order to overcome those allozyme effects and result in the apple race closing early enough in the season to utilize the earlier fruiting apple. Make sense? No? There's different components of diapause, and they're mixed and matches in various ways. So right now, what we're working on is this idea of an energy reserve hypothesis that links the genes and the ecology and the physiology and diapause. And we're thinking maybe the allozymes actually aren't just placemats. They actually may have a more direct role in the diapause profiles we're seeing. That is, the allozymes may act in a temperature-dependent manner to affect stored energy levels in larvae and pupae, and that this then is interacting with other induction and maintenance cues to affect the diapause status in the survivorship or overwintering survivorship of the pupa. And we're doing this work in collaboration with Greg Raglan and Dan Hahn at the University of Florida. And you can think about it as a sort of its energy reserve hypothesis, at least, in that under hot, long pre-wintering conditions, you might think of the genotypes acting in different ways. And so in the larvae, these northern or hawthorn-like genotypes may be slightly better at providing or resulting in an energy level in the pupae entering diapause. But in terms of the energy loss, this high rate of metabolism might really result in a big net difference between the genotypes in energy loss during this phase. And so the net result is that entering diapause, these apple genotypes are better. They're more highly provisioned and fatter. Whereas under cold conditions, the opposite may be true. These high metabolic rate enzymes may be really good at packing in energy during the feeding larval stages, and since it's colder during the pre-wintering stages, the negative consequences might be not so dramatic. And so there will be more minimal loss of energy between the genotypes at this time, resulting in a flip-flop. In fact, these hot genotypes may have larger energy reserves entering diapause than the apple genotypes. And that could potentially explain that gene-environment interaction that we're observing. So how can we test this? Well, this is the interesting omics phase. Greg and Dan have recently been able to characterize now through respirometry and lipid measurements the status of individual pupae. We can now tell through respirometry measurements pretty precisely when the pupae is broken diapause, how fast it's taking during post-diapause development rates. In the initial sort of pupal stages before winter, we can tell what the metabolic rate of those individuals are. So we can get a real now more precise handle at the actual diapause phenotype, and we can do it at the individual level, which is key. And now we can couple it with other projects that are ongoing that we're just finishing up on mass 454 sequencing. So we've now been able to look across all the life cycles or life cycle stages of the Ragulides flies and get the transcriptome, what genes are being expressed through all of these life phases. So we've got about half the genome now, at least with respect to EST sequences. So what does this put us in position to do? Why is this significant? How can we now merge what's going on at the genomics level with the ecophysiology, translate it into reproductive isolation and incipient speciation? Well, since we can now characterize the phenotype and we've got all this nice genetic tools, what we can do things now begin to look at is the expression patterns in individual pupae of individuals that are characterized, at least with respect to the diapause phenotypes, and look for expression differences in candidate genes or even identify candidate genes that might be playing a role in this adaptive process. And then that gives us a handle then into the physiological mechanisms. So we can begin to see whether, in fact, some of these allozymes are up or down regulated during diapause and what level different alleles might be expressed at different stages to sort of directly test that energetics idea. Because we can measure the lipid content of an individual too. So what I'm getting at here then is now we have the genetic tools to really start to complete the whole cycle. The whole life cycle of a study system and the whole life cycle of Maurice and Katie's lifetime of professional influence on us. They showed us the pathway and the vision to get to this point. And now we're getting the genetic tools that we can actually maybe follow it through to completion. So what I've showed you is how a host plant can serve as a temporal resource island, at least during the sympatric host shift, how this can exert multifarious selection pressures across different diapause traits during this shift, how that can translate to ecological reproductive isolation, some of the genetics behind it and the modularity and gene-environment interactions, but now how we can merge the diapause with the ecophysiology and the omics to really get a new metamorphosis that fulfills Maurice and Katie's vision of the role of insect adaptation in life cycle as a new beginning for the genesis of biodiversity for Phytophagous insects. And that's what's really exciting. And so thanks. Thanks for keeping us on the pathways and showing us the pathway, Maurice and Katie.